very pleased to be able to welcome everybody here to Ilan Pape's second event for the Haven Center here at UW. For those of you who were unfortunate enough to have missed his fantastic talk last night, let me introduce him. Ilan Pape is an Israeli historian, now a chair of history at the University of Exeter in London, in England. He is one of the new historians in Israel using archival research to challenge the Israeli mythology about their own state's history. And in particular, his work of late has been devoted to documenting what he calls, in the title of his best-known book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. And this book, along with his book with Noam Chomsky, Gaza in Crisis, are both available for 20% off from Rainbow Books after the talk. So the talk tonight is Squaring the Circle on the Peace Process in Israel and Palestine. Please welcome Ilan Pape.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming again, those of you who are here for the second time. I talked last night about the history, in a way, of Israel and Palestine from the very limited perspective I chose up to 1967, 1968. So in a way, it's appropriate to continue that history from 1968 onwards. And again, as I did last night, I do it from I slice that reality, because that's the only thing you can do in a talk of 30-35 minutes, which covers such a complex issue. Whereas I focused last night on the paradigm of the ethnic cleansing as an ideological infrastructure that explains the Israeli policies, and before that the Zionist policies towards the native indigenous population of Palestine, I would like to focus tonight on the history from 1967 and bring it as much as possible to the current situation through the prism of the so-called peace process. And again, this is a reductionist way of looking at things, but it's a very convenient, I think, way of explaining at least my own take on the developments since 1967. I already mentioned last night, but I will repeat it for those who haven't been here, and this will be a good starting point, that the peace process, in a way, was conceived geographically between Washington and Jerusalem, or between Washington and Tel Aviv, more or less in the very last days of 1969 and the early days of 1970. And maybe it's because of my professional bias that I believe that however you formulate things in the formative period of a process, they have a lasting effect, an impact on the nature of the process in years to come. And it's very difficult to deviate from the basics that have been formulated in the departure point, and in fact the only way of changing the course of the so-called peace process is to redesign it. And that would be my conclusion towards the end, that actually if you want to get out of the deadlock, you have to go back to the desk and redraw the very basics of what is peace all about. It's one thing politicians, for example, cannot do, because they think about a very short-term perspective. They think about the next election. They would never be able to engage in a fundamental process of rethinking. All they can do is try to refine the existing paradigm and batter it to death if it doesn't work. So they will try and go to the basic ideas of the peace process and say, okay, let's try it from a different angle. And then let's try it from another angle. And usually when everything collapses in a big bang, that's when they are convinced that the paradigm is not valid anymore. I think we're very near that. We're very near the point that the paradigm of peace, as it was conceived in 69-1970, is about to collapse, to disappear. The problem in history is that usually, as in science, paradigms do not replace one another immediately. There is a transitional period, which is quite chaotic and sometimes quite dangerous. But it's inevitable, unfortunately. So what was the paradigm that dominated our life in Israel and Palestine under the title The Peace Process? Or as my friend Noam Chomsky calls it, the so-called peace process. And if I wasn't tired enough, every time that I would mention the peace process, I should do like this. I know from experience as being a lecturer that audiences get a bit confused if you continue to do like this, and they don't know exactly how to treat this bizarre lecturer and his gesticulation. So I will try not to do it too often. In between Washington and Jerusalem, political scientists, diplomats, experts on the Arab world worked out something that the Secretary of State in the 1990s, Mordecai Albright, described quite well. Because as you probably know, Mordecai Albright in the American revolving door kind of system, like Kissinger before her, had an academic background and a political career. So she was able to articulate things both as a politician and as an academic. And I think she described it well, not critically, by the way. She was very much in favor of that paradigm. But I think she did find the right words of telling us what was born there in 69-1970 and with which we are still living today. She said, in every conflict, the best you can do if you are an outside mediator or a peace broker is to look at everything that is visible and make it divisible. Everything which is visible is divisible. Anything in a conflict which looks invisible, namely that you cannot really see, is indivisible, and therefore the peace negotiator should leave that aside. That meant, in the case of Israel and Palestine, that the most tangible aspects of the conflict were territory, which are very visible and very easily divisible. It meant that natural resources, populations, anything material that is on the ground can be divided. It also means, for instance, that history, ethics, morality, question of culpability are not part of the equation. And in many ways, if you look at the basic Palestinian position in 1969 and the basic consensual Israeli Zionist position in 1969-1970, you would see that if you adopt Mordecai Albright's idea of divisibility, you are totally siding with the Israeli side. In fact, in any conflict in the world where you have a basic imbalance of power, and usually a conflict that is born in situations of injustice, such as colonization, occupation, dispossession, it's quite often the victim that talks about what Mordecai Albright would describe as the invisible characteristics of the conflict. And it would be the stronger party that would talk about divisibility. And not only that, you divide and you accompany the action or the act of division with a narrative or a dictionary or a language of concessions. You are powerful, you've occupied, you've colonized, you're in control, you're willing to divide, that's why there is a chance for peace, but you're willing to divide, that's very important. There is a willingness on your side, you're willing to concede. From the victim's point of view, all you are doing is telling them, you know, we'll tolerate your existence and we will stop the victimization at a certain point, but we will not in any way or form give you a chance to change the imbalance or to rectify past evils. Any one of you has followed struggles of indigenous people here in North America, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Latin America, would understand what I'm talking about. Anyone who is following the struggles of minorities in society would know what I'm talking about. This whole notion that the powerful party in the balance of power, if at all it adopts the language of peace, it's a language of concession, of goodwill. And this was adopted, I think, in 1969, 1970. More concretely, what it meant is the following. It meant that if you really wanted to involve the Israelis in a peace process, or if the Israelis themselves thought that the peace process was something that would serve them well, right? If you wanted to go in that direction, you have to paint the reality of 69, 1970 as a reality in which Israel actually can continue without a peace process, but it's doing a favor, maybe to the Palestinians, maybe to the Arab world, maybe to the Americans, maybe to the West, maybe to peace world, doesn't matter. But there is a kind of benevolence in this act because they really don't have to do this. And it meant concretely that there is no historical dimension to the peace process. The peace process begins at the moment, the peace process deals with the conflict as if it starts at the moment that the strong party says, okay, I'm willing to engage in the peace process. So when the Israelis are willing to engage in the peace process, and that happens around 69, 1970, with William Rogers initiative and then with the Kissinger initiative. So we're talking about between 1969 to 1970. Mm-hmm. It means that anything that happened up to 1969 or 1970 is not negotiable. It's not part of the story. So you negotiate, first of all, over the fate of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, if we talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Anything that is not within this geographical framework is not negotiable, not even talked about. But even if there are already established facts on the ground in 1969, and there were not that many, but there were already some established facts, like the Israelis have already ethnically cleansed some neighborhoods in Jerusalem. The Israeli already declared in 67 that Jerusalem is united in the de jure annexation. The Israelis have already allowed some groups of settlers to colonize small parts of the West Bank. These are not negotiable anymore, because the goodwill of Israel means that you negotiate over the areas where established facts have not been yet implemented on the ground. Now, from a Palestinian perspective, it means that you need to be in such a desperate mood to accept it that it takes time, even if you're very pragmatic and you come to the conclusion that actually you have to do something because it's existential. By the time that you agree to enter, the negotiations. And as you know, the PLO enters the negotiations only in 1988. So it takes the PLO 20 years before it decides to engage in this game, right? 1988, the first American PLO negotiations, the Palestinian Declaration of Independence, and finally a Palestinian involvement for the first time in the peace process. The moment they agree to play the game in 1988, it means again that all the facts that Israel established on the ground between 1968 or 1988 are not negotiable. In fact, there is a didactic element to this, which comes very clearly in the peace proposals that are being prepared in the late 1980s, even before the beginning of the Oslo process. The didactic element in this is the following. Since you did not agree to engage in the negotiations when we offered you, you are going to be offered less as part of our goodwill and concession. And because you have to learn a lesson there. So to make sure that you are not delaying again your willingness to go along with this. In until 1988, as you probably know, because the Palestinians, through their main legitimate and only, in a way, representative body, the PLO, were not playing the game of peace until 1988. The Israelis and the Americans were playing with what one can call the Jordanian option. They sort of appointed, with the voluntary agreement of the Jordanians, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan as a kind of a partner for such a peace. It would be a waste of time to talk about it too much. It's very clear why the Jordanians didn't mind playing the game. It's very clear why the Israelis preferred the Jordanians to the Palestinians. And it is equally clear why it was a total failure and a waste of time, and in between a waste of quite a few people's life with this Jordanian option. But because the Israeli Labor Party was very keen on this, because the Americans were very keen on this, and some Arab regimes were very keen on this, the game continued. But of course, really, it's one of the chapters in the history of so-called peace negotiation that didn't produce anything. I mean, there are not that many cases in history where 20 years of negotiations don't produce even one agreement, even a marginal agreement. Now, from 1988 onwards, because the PLO, mainly for reasons that have to do with a strategic reevaluation on the part of the Palestinian leadership, right or wrong, we can talk about it later, but they decided that because of the end of the Cold War and the monopoly that the Americans had all over the region, that it was better to be involved in a Pax Americana than to reject it. Was it a mistake or not? History will judge. But the fact is that in 1988, most of the people who composed the leadership of the PLO felt that entering Pax Americana was the only option valid, especially because of the eruption of the first uprising in December 1987, the first Intifada, where it was very clear that the PLO was losing its touch with the occupied population, that instigated its own uprising, actually singling out to the leadership that the time that was wasted between 67 and 1988, whether on an inefficient armed struggle or a futile diplomacy, did not change the reality on the ground. On the contrary, allowed the Israelis to expropriate more land, arrest more people, demolish houses, and really make life quite miserable for the occupied people. So I think it was a response both to the change in the global reality and the impatience, if you want, of the occupied people themselves, that the PLO decided to try and play the game of Pax Americana. And there were two interesting American notions about how to manage the peace process from 1988 onwards. One was to allow the Israelis to dictate the agenda. And that idea, which is much more closer to the Democratic Party, interestingly enough, and was less popular with at least some Republicans, but the Democratic Party, or people who were around the Democratic Party, especially liberal Jews, thought that peace meant asking the Israelis what is a consensual perception of peace that the Israelis can agree to. And that consensual perception became very clear in a while, and one can see it even today. The consensual perception, namely the one peace initiative that you could push forward without risking too much the integrity of the society, the cohesion of the Jewish community inside Israel, is one which regards the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as an area that is basically divided into two zones. And these zones change with time, but not in principle. One zone is an area that has to be directly controlled by Israel, or annexed by Israel. Whether these are what the Israelis nowadays call the big settlement blocks, or whether they are the settlements that look very much like cities anyway, or whether this is the Jordan Valley because of its strategic value, it doesn't matter, right? One thing it's always impossible to explain to the Americans who haven't been there, how small this land is. So once you begin to slice the West Bank, which is almost 20, if not less, even 19% of Palestine, you begin to slice the 19% and you say part of it, even in a liberal Zionist point of view, has to be part of Israel. In terms of real square miles, not much is left, but put that aside. But the idea was that part of it has to be annexed to Israel, and has to be an integral part of Israel. And the language in Israel developed in the 1980s in such a way. For example, not one Israeli I know, not one Israeli Jewish I know, calls the colonized settlements in the greater Jerusalem areas itnachluyot, settlements. They are called neighborhoods. They are an integral part of the city. And most Israelis really don't understand when you talk about these as settlements, which still, by the way, the State Department talks about them as settlements. Illegal settlements. They're illegal settlements by any definition of international law. But the consensual perception in Israel was that these areas were always Israel. Maybe there was a brief moment of 19 years that they were not, but they were always Israel. So that's one zone. One zone is not negotiable. That's the point. In 1988, part of the West Bank is already not negotiable. Didactically, because it was on offer in 67, and the Palestinian, with the famous saying of Abba Ibn, never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity, and therefore, didactically, they lost. They lost that part. And secondly, because that's the only way you can commodify, that's the only way you can package what the Israelis claim would be a traumatic idea of withdrawing from the areas Israel occupied in 1967. Now, imagine from a Palestinian perspective, where the whole of Palestine should be negotiated, they actually find themselves in 1988 and onwards until today already negotiating and fighting for the 50% of the 20% that he's left. It's a brilliant, actually, act of diplomacy on Israel's side, if you want, to make the Palestinians, at least those Palestinians who were willing to engage in it, totally deviate and forget their basic perceptions of the reality. The other zone is negotiable. It's definitely negotiable. It can be 60% of the West Bank and the whole of the Gaza Strip. Sometimes it's 90% of the West Bank and the whole of the Gaza Strip. It changes. It changes according to the Israeli strategic thinking, to the wish of the American to pressure. But there the negotiation is about how much autonomy, how much sovereignty, how much actual control would the Palestinians have on that particular part. And the Israelis, contrary to what people think, already in 1988 had played the game of statehood. There is a clear equation that becomes more explicit in the Oslo report. And the equation is the following. The more, in Arabic, I would say, that those of you who understand Arabic, the Israeli equation was even pronounced in Arabic at the time by Moshe Dayan and afterwards by Rabin and others, is if you offer the Palestinians Salata, they're not getting any Sulta. But if they want Sulta, it was with less Salata. So for those of you who are Anglo-Saxons, it means that if you want the perks of a state, if you want the histrionics of the state, your real control would be very limited. If you want a bit more of a real control, you have to give up the symbols. Right? That's the idea. You have to choose. Do you want a flag, a palace, the charade of a state? Then, in reality, you would have only the perks, but not the control. If you want to have a bit more of a control, then you have to give up the histrionics and the charade of the state. And this was the Israeli consensus. This was the basic Israeli consensus. And it hasn't changed. Peace means an Israeli willingness to give up territorially part of the West Bank, part of the Gaza Strip, maybe the whole of the Gaza Strip. Again, the Gaza Strip is 2% of Palestine. And the part which will not be directly controlled by Israel can be indirectly controlled in different means. And this is the end of the conflict. This is the end of the conflict. It's quite surprising how many Palestinians, for a very brief moment in history, which could be 10 years, thought that this was a serious offer throughout the years. Why did they think it was a serious offer? Out of desperation, maybe some of them without giving any names, like the idea of the Salata, the perks. Others thought that, and I know one of them who said it to me and to others very openly, of the leaders, who said, if I have effective control over 2% of Palestine, this is better than nothing. These are rationalization for the worst kind of deal that you can get. But it worked for a while, and it fueled the wheels of the peace process. Now, this was the democratic American take on peace. You go to the Israelis, whether they are experts, whether they are diplomats, whether whoever eventually makes up the decision, and those Israelis come up with the program of peace, and I just described the logic of this program. It hasn't changed from then until now. And then, of course, you have to find the Palestinians who would be willing to play with this, and you dictate to them how to do this. Interestingly, the old experts on Arab affairs who hovered around the Republican Party had a different idea. And you can see it in the Madrid conference in 1991. You can see it in the things that are developed under the presidency of the senior Bush administration, they did not accept the idea of everything which is visible is divisible, and they were willing, I don't know why, but they were willing to take the Palestinian perspective as a legitimate input in discussing peace. And that's why it had no chance, because the Israelis immediately stopped it. If you look, for instance, if you compare the Oslo Accord of 1993 and the Madrid Conference in 1991, the Madrid Conference, which is George Bush Sr.'s project, right? The Madrid Conference brings all the Arab states to the negotiating table, brings the PLO, and allows the PLO to put a Palestinian perspective of peace, which can be summarized as, first and foremost, insistence on the right of the Palestinian refugees to return, not giving up the idea that the whole of Palestine should be liberated and turn into a democratic state, and the need to accept Israel eventually, after that is happening, or the Jewish community in Israel, as part of the Middle East eventually. It's a kind of a comprehensive deal, if you want. And this is not accepted by the Republicans. I'm not saying it was accepted, but it was legitimized as a departure point for negotiation vis-a-vis an Israeli position. And the Israelis were very worried in 1991 about this. So they started the Oslo negotiations. I know, because I was part of the team in those days in 1992. I know it firsthand how the Oslo agreement started. I was in my sins thinking at the time maybe my communist period was wrong and I wanted to give a chance to the Labour Party. So I was involved in those early days, so I know the things, how they developed from within. And the main thing was a great apprehension of the kind of ideas that the Americans were pushing forward through the Madrid Conference. It was really a worrying moment for the Israelis. And Shimon Peres and his advisors devised the idea of going back to the Israeli perception, or what I call the Israeli consensus perception of peace, packaging it in a way that they hoped that the PLO would accept. And to their great surprise, the PLO, or more precisely Yasser Arafat, was quite excited about the idea. Why was he excited? Did he believe them when they told him already in the first meetings in Oslo, before that in London, I remember, when they told him that the first stage of such a peace process would be totally according to the Israeli agenda? Namely, he would receive, as a leader of the Palestinians, part of the West Bank that could become a kind of a state. And if everything works well, then the other issues, such as the refugees, the fate of the rest of the Palestinians, the fate of Jerusalem, would be discussed. But there was, again, a didactic mechanism that he accepted, or maybe he misunderstood, I don't know, but he accepted that if you behave well, the next stage is accepting the Palestinian perception. This, by the way, convinced those in the United States who were not so keen on that idea to join eventually and support the Oslo peace process. Now, if you read the document, which is quite long, of the Oslo peace process, there is clause number 5 and sub-clause number 3. This should have alerted Arafat, and it alerted him. Someone alerted him in the last moment, if you remember the scene in Cairo, where he's supposed to sign the Oslo B agreement, and he refuses. And behind the scene, Mubarak and his entourage are pushing him physically, if you remember. I don't know if those of you have seen it on TV. If not, try and find it. I'm sure it's the footage is still there. He's being pushed physically to sign the final accord of the Oslo Accord, which was Oslo B. It's amazing that in only 1995 he noticed clause 3 sub clause 5 sub clause 3. Clause 5 sub clause 3, which was prepared by Israeli lawyers. As I told you yesterday, the Israelis defeated the Palestinians more, not so much with military power, financial competence, but by detailing them to death. That's the Israeli way of torturing you. They detail you to death. And that detailing to death was clause 5, subclause 3. What does so clause 5, subclause 3 says? It says, should everything go according to plan, namely the Israeli control over the West Bank, the Palestinian half autonomy in those parts where Israel are not interested in, the Israeli security arrangement, Israeli control on the Jordan River, all the Israeli demands, should they be met without any interference from the Palestinians, 5 years into the Oslo Agreement, the issues which concern the Palestinians would be negotiated, namely the refugees, the fate of the settlements, the future of Jerusalem, and the status of the rest of the Palestinian people. It's all there. Now, if you negotiate something, and I tell you that the most sacred ideas for me are 1, 2, 3, 4. In a document which has 55 clauses, my most sacred, most important taboos appear in clause 5, subclause 3, my instinct should be that I'm being misled. But it's amazing how people were not aware of this. I remember the late Edward Said and Hasnin Haikal, the Egyptian journalist, who probably would live to be 520, given the way he looks now at the age of 145. Hasnin Haikal and Edward Said and Ibrahim Abu Nurud went to see Arafat in Tunisia. Edward Said writes about it in his two booklets about the peace process. And they noticed, they read the agreement, and they noticed clause 5, subclause 3. And Arafat said to them, I don't read this agreement. This is not important. What is important is the balance of power. We don't have the Soviet Union. We made a mistake in supporting the Iraqis when they occupied Kuwait. Nobody is on our side. So we'll take whatever they give us. It doesn't. Why do I have to read? And psychologically, it's so interesting that when the Israelis, 2 years into the Oslo Agreement, have reinterpreted clause 5, subclause 3, reinterpreted, they said, already 2 years into the Oslo Agreement, this is just before Rabin was assassinated, because sometimes we idealize Rabin just because he was assassinated. He was not pushing for peace. I can assure you that. He was not pushing for peace. He was pushing for the Israeli version of peace, which has nothing to do with peace. It has to do with with occupation in other means. And that's another story. But in any case, 2 years into the Oslo Agreement, the Israelis say, we already know that you're not going to keep your promise to behave. Now, objectively, one should say that the rejection in Palestine to the Oslo Agreement was manifested in a series of suicide bombing, demonstrations, armed opposition, so the Israelis could accumulate evidence that the Palestinian leadership is not keeping its side. So already into that agreement, they reinterpreted clause 5, subclause 3 by saying, because of your inability to keep your promise, A, we don't know for how long we're going to postpone the next stage of the final status, but far more important, we have a new idea. We'll divide that area that you will have, which is much smaller than the area we were willing to give you, again, because you were missing opportunities, into two areas, area B and C. Area A is totally our control. B and C, or the other way around, doesn't matter, as long as you remember the three categories. B is a joint control of us and your security forces. The other one is supposedly total control by the Palestinians. Now, in terms of percentage, I don't want to bore you too much. I don't want to detail you to death. Not much is left as independent Palestinian control in the end of it. And that's kind of a punishment to the Palestinians. The idea of Oslo B, as it was called, areas A, B, and C, was a punishment for not fulfilling the promise in clause 5, sub clause 3. And when Arafat was asked to sign it, if you remember, in the theater hall in Cairo, those of you who were watching it as I did, he suddenly didn't want to sign it. And he was forced to do it. It's a picture that doesn't leave me all my life, because I knew the man and I knew many people around him, and it was quite dramatic, what one should say that. Now, it's interesting that at that stage, when it's very clear that this whole elaborate edifice that the Israelis have built together with the Americans, which is how to dictate to the Palestinians an occupation by other means and declare it as a final peace. This was the formula. When this failed, actually, in 1995, also because of Rabin's assassination and the election of the Netanyahu government, but also because it had never had any chance of to be a reality, right? And the result, as you know, was the growing of the Hamas, the Islamic, political Islamic opposition to the Oslo Accord. I don't have to tell you all the details on the ground, 1996, 1997. The interesting thing is the inertia of politicians. Every student, first year student of political science, every history student, every perceptive, intelligent, and even not so intelligent person would in 1996 say, this paradigm is not working. Some would say it's not working because it's unjust. Others would say it's not working because we can see the facts on the ground. It's not working. And the facts on the ground, as you know, included not just the failure of implementing the clauses, but the expansion of the Jewish settlement, the expropriation of land, the imprisonment of Palestinians, and the Palestinian reaction through suicide bombs and other means. So even if you did not judge it ethically or morally, you could see that practically it's not working. But this is the inertia of politicians and diplomats. Nobody among those who had the power to offer anything new had dared to say there's something wrong with the paradigm. They kept adopting the paradigm to the changing reality rather than allowing the reality to force them to change the paradigm. So the paradigm in 1997, in 1998, looks even more ridiculous. There's a stage in the conflict in Camp David in the summer of 2000 when Ehud Barak, who has a minority government in Israel, which means, again, practically, that it doesn't matter what he would agree in Camp David, he would not be able to pass it through the Israeli political system. So it didn't even matter whether there would have been an agreement between Clinton and Arafat and Barak in the summer of 2000. That doesn't matter. But the paradigm means that they play as if there is a chance. And they try to repackage the paradigm in the following way. They change the percentage. It's a clever game. You know, the Israelis worked on it for 5 months. For 5 months, they repackaged their perception of peace, while the Palestinians were doing nothing at the time. It didn't matter. In the end of the day, it didn't matter. They didn't do anything. The Palestinians, by the way, in the last moment, approached the Adam Smith Institute in London and asked them to prepare a counter master plan to the Israeli plan for the summer of 2000. I know because the Adam Smith Institute approached me to help and write the chapter on the refugees. It was pathetic, both if you know what the Adam Smith Institute is, and the fact that the Palestinian Institute needed a right-wing think tank in London to help them to prepare for that pathetic meeting in Camp David. But that doesn't matter. What really matters is how the Israeli packaged the New Deal. The New Deal was the following. You take out the Greater Jerusalem area from what you call the West Bank, right? Which is almost one third of the West Bank. And then you say, you prevent the narrative of the most generous offer ever been made by Israel to the Palestinians. I hope you understand the arithmetic. It's a bit late in the day. It's not that complicated, right? I'm about to offer you actually 50% of something. But because I squeezed that something, the 50% looked like 70%. Right? That's what they did. They take the greater Jerusalem area out of the equation and they say, which they are next to Israel. Right? And say, the two-thirds are the complete West Bank. And out of this new complete West Bank, which is just two-thirds of the West Bank, we are giving you almost 95%. There isn't one Israeli Jew I know, and there isn't one American supporter of Israeli Jews that I know, that wouldn't tell you that in Camp David 2000, the Palestinians were offered almost 97% of the West Bank. Am I right? I mean, you can, if you don't believe me, just open the website of the Israeli embassy in Washington. This was a generous offer. Mm-hmm. They were offered 97%. They were not offered 97%. They were offered much less. The second repackaging, it's amazing what people allow themselves. The second repackaging was redefining the idea of sovereignty in a way that you wouldn't find even in the most amateurish and sloppy political science book definition of a state. They redefined statehood in a way that the mayor of Madison looks like really a president of the United States compared to what would look the president of the Palestine that was offered in Camp David. And it's incredible. Now, Arafat, as you know, in 2000 was very fragile. And the fact that Barak, you remember the picture, he pushes him forcefully, I think didn't help. Probably that's what killed him in the end of the day. And not the Israeli poison. The Arafat looked at that, and even he understood that this was too much. The game was so clear. Now the Israeli repackaged the package in Taba. This narrative is important. It is important to know it. The Israelis take the Palestinians to Taba in the Sinai and say, no, wait a minute, we want to be even more generous. And they say, we're even willing to allow you to a return of a small number of refugees to show you, remember clause 5, sub clause 3, that we are willing to deal with sub clause 5, sub clause 3. But you have two options. And if you think about it, this is all so stupid, but it was taken very seriously. You have two options, the liberal Zionists said. You can either allow 100,000 refugees out of 5.5 million to go back, and that's it. Or you can take back the refugees only to that part which would be eventually Palestine, which is one third of the two thirds, of the two thirds of the five thirds, and so on, which not much is that. I mean, the cheese, the Swiss cheese that was supposed to be Palestine. And this is a more generous offer than the generous offer, right? This is the best generous offer ever made. The frustration of the Palestinians, even those who went as pragmatically as they could with their ideas, came out in the Second Intifada. Of course the Second Intifada was much more violent than the first one. The frustration was much bigger. And what do the powers that be, how do they respond? By changing the paradigm? You have a second uprising? Do they change the paradigm? On the contrary. They say, oh, we have to tweak the paradigm again. There's a new reality. And then you have the roadmap that leads to nowhere. Then you have all kinds of plans that come under the names of officials in the State Department, if you notice. Now, if you look from 2000 to 2011, the names of the program are attached to less and less senior officials in the State Department. The time passes by, the less senior is the official in the State Department under which the new plan is named. Because everybody understands this is not a very important issue. Bush the second, junior, already gives up the game anyway. Because he is a Republican. When the Democrats come before that, Clinton And Obama, and this is the worst thing about the Obama administration, Obama has brought back all the wizards of Oz from the Clinton administration to repackage for the fifth time this horrible commodity, which is called the peace process. And they're really surprised that there's no one to talk to, not even on the Israeli side. This is not because the Israeli political map has swung, has moved to the right. That's not the reason. Even the Israelis cannot stand anymore the repackaging. Can you imagine? I mean, you take sour milk from the fridge, and you add sugar, and then you add salt, and then you add eggs, and then you put it outside in the heat, and then you freeze it, and you defreeze it. Who can? You can't smell it anymore. Well, that's what happened to the so-called peace process. And unfortunately, on the ground, nobody is offering anything new. This is still the dominant narrative. The peace process is still the dominant narrative. On top of it, they appointed Tony Blair to be the main emissary that has to now resell this sour milk to us as a peace process. You know, appointing Tony Blair to the peace process is like appointing Dracula to have a blood bank. I mean, they have something in common. They have something in common, but you wouldn't trust the one in the hands of the other. And everybody sees it, and yet it doesn't move. Now, let me finish by saying the following. The fact that there is such a gap between the deliberations, the discussions on the so-called peace process, which feed academics, diplomats, politicians, and there's a gap with all time is growing, and the reality on the ground, which is more occupation, more oppression. Because the gap is so big, it's very clear that we are somewhere on the road to the disappearance of that paradigm. Not again because somebody would sit down logically and say we need a new paradigm, but because there's a limit. I wrote somewhere that the United Nations discussion on the state of Palestine is the end of the of this paradigm. It is the end of this paradigm because there's nothing more bizarre than a United Nations endorsement for a paradigm that does not exist. The Americans support it, the Russians support it, now the United Nations support it, and they support a non-existing idea, right? So people would have to bring up a new idea. The new idea is not easy to produce. It's easy to write about, but it's not easy to produce. But I really see no other choice than for everybody concerned to go back to the desk and in many ways go back to the ideas of the Madrid conference and say this conflict has a history and its origins is the source of the illness. Everything that came afterwards is a symptom. If you don't deal with the refugee issue, if you don't deal with the fate of the whole of the land that was Palestine, if you don't include all the Palestinians in that negotiations, the paradigm would be the same. You cannot shrink Palestine geographically, and you cannot shrink Palestine demographically. The more you include the territory and the demography in it, the more you have a chance of solving the problem. Now, I'm not naive. I know that this is anathema to most Israelis and to most of those who are engaged in the peace process. But I think that either through the realities, or rather disastrous realities on the ground, or hopefully through kind of a pressure from below, the false paradigm of parity, the false paradigm of the peace process would be replaced by a paradigm that is far more authentic, far more relevant to the reality on the ground, and which is based on not on parity, but on equality, which is a very different notion. Equality of citizen rights, of human rights, whether you are a settler or you are indigenous, it doesn't matter. The human, the equal rights is something that also has a way of dealing with history, but also looking forward towards the future. And I will end by saying in order to re-describe, to repackage my own paradigm with three A's, which I think are the basis for the future. Three A's. One is acknowledgement. Unless the Israelis would acknowledge the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948 and all the ethnic cleansing policies and operations since 1948, there will never be peace. That's acknowledgement. The second A is accountability. Acknowledgement is not enough. You have to be accountable. And the best way to translate accountability in the case of the Israelis is first and foremost to recognize, at least in principle, the right of the Palestinian refugees to return. The third A is acceptance. I think it's the Palestinian agency in this is to accept the ethnic Jewish community that developed in the last 62 years, or maybe in the last 100 years, as a legitimate part of the solution, which is not easy for Palestinians and neighboring Arab societies to accept. But I think that if you have acknowledgement, accountability, you will also have that acceptance. This, to my mind, are the only guiding principles for those who should build the new paradigm from scratch in the case of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Thank you.